Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitamstam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamstam Panchakalpati Vishakhi Pasmini Vitapati Jnam Havane Javaisalevi Namo 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 Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Let me ask Mataji.
Yes.
There is something wrong with your voice. It's as if you're not placing, the mic is not close to you or something. Your voice is going in and out.
I can try using a plug-in mic instead of using my computer mic, but using my computer mic is fine. You want me to try using headphones?
Whatever you just said right now was fine.
Oh, okay.
So don't have your mouth right in front of the mic or something.
Okay, all right. So as long as it's fine, just let me know if there's any problem. Okay, so it is June 29, 2022, from Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, The Creative Impetus. Chapter 1, The Activities in Maharaj Priyavrata, Text 22, and this is in prose, so I'll just read the verse. Manur api parenaivam pratisandhita manoratha surasa varun atend atmajam akila dara mandala stita guptaya astapya swayam ati vishama vishaya visha jala saya shashaya upararama. Manu.
Manu.
Swayambhuva Manu.
Swayambhuva Manu.
Api.
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 Also.
Also.
Parena.
Parena.
By Lord Brahma.
By Lord Brahma.
Evam.
Evam.
Thus.
Thus.
Pratisandita.
Pratisandita.
Executed. Manarataha.
Manarataha.
His mental aspiration.
His mental aspiration.
Sura Rishi Vara.
Sura Rishi Vara.
Of the great sage Narada.
Of the great sage Narada.
Anumatena.
Anumatena.
By the permission.
By the permission.
Atmajam. His son. Akila.
Akila.
Of the entire universe. Dara Mandala.
Dara Mandala.
Of planets. Siti.
Siti.
Maintenance.
Maintenance.
Guptaye.
Okay.
For the protection.
For the
Asapya.
Asapya.
Establishing.
Establishing.
Swayam.
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 Personally.
Personally.
Ati Vishama.
Ati Vishama.
Very dangerous.
Very dangerous.
Vishaya.
Vishaya.
Material affairs.
Visha.
Visha.
Of poison.
Of poison.
Jala Ashaya.
Jala Ashaya.
Ocean.
Ocean.
Ashayaha.
Ashayaha.
From desires.
From desires.
There's
Upararama.
Upararama.
Got relief.
Before we continue, is
Srila Prabhupada's translation. Swayambhuva Manu, with the assistance of Lord Brahma, thus fulfilled his desires. With the permission of the great sage Narada, he delivered to his son the governmental responsibility for maintaining and protecting all the planets of the universe. He thus achieved relief from the most dangerous, poisonous ocean of material desires. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Swayambhuva Manu was practically hopeless because such a great personality as Narada was instructing his son Priyavrata not to accept household life. Now he was very pleased that Lord Brahma had interfered by inducing his son to accept the responsibility for ruling the government of the universe. From Bhagavad Gita we get information that Vaivasvata Manu was the son of the sun god and that his son, Maharaj Ishvaku, ruled this earth planet. Swayambhuva Manu, however, appears to have been in charge of the entire universe, and he entrusted to his son, Maharaj Priyavrata, the responsibility for maintaining and protecting all the planetary systems. Dhara Mandala means planet. This earth, for instance, is called Dhara Mandala. Akila, however, means all or universal. It is therefore difficult to understand where Maharaj Priyavrata was situated, but from this literature his position certainly appears greater than that of Ishvaku, for he was entrusted with all the planetary systems of the entire universe. Another significant statement is that Swayambhuva Manu took great satisfaction from abnegating the responsibility for ruling all the planetary systems of the universe. At present, politicians are very eager to take charge of the government, and they engage their men in canvassing from door to door to get votes to win the post of president or a similar exalted office. On the contrary, however, herein we find that King Priyavrata had to be persuaded by Lord Brahma to accept the post of emperor of the entire universe. Similarly, his father, Swayambhuva Manu, felt relieved to entrust the universal government to Priyavrata. Thus, it is evident that the kings and executive heads of government in the Vedic age never accepted their positions for sense enjoyment. Such exalted kings, who were known as Rajarshis, ruled only to maintain and protect the kingdom for the welfare of the citizens. The history of Priyavrata and Swayambhuva Manu describes how exemplary, responsible monarchs performed the duties of government with disinterest, keeping themselves always aloof from the contamination of material attachments. Material affairs have herein been compared to an ocean of poison. They have been described in a similar way by Srila Narottama Das Thakur in one of his songs, Samsara Vishale Dvya Nisa Hiya Dwale Judaite Na Kainyu Upaya. My heart is always burning in the fire of material existence, and I have made no provisions for getting out of it. Golok Erik Premadhana Harinama Sankirtana Rati Na Janmila Kene Taya. The only remedy is Harinam Sankirtan, the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, which is imported from the spiritual world Goloka Vrindavana. How unfortunate I am that I have no attraction for this. Manu wanted to seek shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord, and therefore when his son Priyavrata took charge of his worldly affairs, Manu was very relieved. That is the system of Vedic civilization. At the end of life, one must free himself from worldly affairs and completely engage in the service of the Lord. The word Suarshi Varya Anumatena is also significant. Manu entrusted the government to his son with the permission of the great Saint Narada. This is particularly mentioned because although Narada wanted Priyavrata to become free from all material affairs, when Priyavrata took charge of the universe by the request of Lord Brahma and Manu, Narada was also very pleased. Swayambhuva Manu, with the assistance of Lord Brahma, thus fulfilled his desires. With the permission of the great sage Narada, he delivered to his son the governmental responsibility for maintaining and protecting all the planets of the universe. He thus achieved relief from the most dangerous, poisonous ocean of material desires. Well, this is very odd. I mean, it's really very, very odd. We have Narada Muni, who instructs Priyavrata to just be a renunciate, to not take up any position of responsibility or livelihood in the world, not to marry, just to stay in the Gandhara Madana hills and chant and hear and worship. And then Narada Muni's really happy when Priyavrata stops doing that and does all the things that he had asked him not to do. So that's rather strange. I mean, what's also very strange here is that Swayambhuva Manu is very happy that he can give up all of this responsibility, and he's also very happy that his son is taking it up. I mean, generally, those of us who are parents, we want for our children what we want for ourselves. We don't want something for our children that we ourselves don't like. So if he didn't like ruling the universe, why is he very happy that his son is ruling the universe? So this is also a big mystery. And another big mystery is that ruling the universe is described here as like some material affairs that are full of poison, an ocean of poison. And yet at the same time, here we have Lord Brahma, Narada Muni, Swayambhuva Manu, who are all seemingly asking Priyavrata to be swimming in or drinking perhaps this ocean of poison. And this confusion about, you know, what does it mean to be engaged in the service of the Lord, to be fully engaged in the service of the Lord? It's something that confuses religious leaders and religious followers in general. I think it's a confusion in many religious systems. It's certainly a confusion at the present time in 2022 for those of us who are followers of Lord Chaitanya, those of us who are followers of Srila Prabhupada. In fact, I would say it's one of the main areas of confusion, and it's one of the main areas where people really kind of mess up their lives and the lives of other people. So is getting married, here we're talking about household life, Prabhupada talked about in the first sentence, getting married and taking some big responsibility. I mean, I don't think any of us are going to be asked to take responsibility on this level of ruling the entire universe with all of its planetary systems. All the planetary systems of the entire universe. Wow, I mean, I don't think any of us are going to be asked to rule the planet. In fact, I don't think any of us are probably even going to be asked to rule a country or even a city. But, you know, taking on getting married, taking on these responsibilities, versus just not taking on any responsibilities in the world and not taking on a family. You know, what do you do? What's best? What's ideal? And this kind of demarcation, and this purport and this verse seem to be making this kind of demarcation, that ruling the universe and having a family are material and they're poisonous and best to get rid of them as soon as possible and give them to someone else and just do the angas of bhakti. There is a game we used to play when I was a child called Hot Potato. And you have a potato that's hot. We usually would play this like outside around a campfire. So you're cooking potatoes in the campfire, and you take one of them out, and it's hot. And then you're sitting in a circle around the fire, and you throw the potato to someone else. And you have to throw it fast enough so that your hands don't get burned. So it seems that this universal rulership is kind of like this hot potato, where you hold it as little as possible and you pass it on to someone else. At the same time, the Lord seems to want people to rule the universe, and his pure devotees seem to want people to rule the universe, and they seem to want other pure devotees to rule the universe. All right, so let's see if we can try to untangle this. You know, religions are often categorized by sociologists as a world denying or world embracing. So the world denying religions are the ones that really promote renunciation. Renunciation of family, renunciation of money, renunciation of work in the world. And the world accepting religions are the ones that promote material prosperity as something that is wanted. Now, in the world denying religions, if everybody lives in a world denying fashion, the religion dies out very, very fast, because no religion in the history of the earth has ever survived without producing children who are socialized in that religion. So if nobody has children, then that doesn't work. And if everybody lives very far away from society and doesn't engage in preaching, that also just doesn't work. So if everyone's in a monastery, I remember reading in Vishakha's memoir about Srila Prabhupada, how she had met these Buddhist monks who lived in a remote mountainous region. And the thing that struck her the most about them was how they were uninterested in fame. They would basically live a life of being complete unknowns. You know, nobody would remember their name, nobody would remember what they had done. They would live separate from human society, not have any descendants, not create anything within the world, and just live and die without practically speaking anyone's notice. So that's a total world-denying religion. And the world-embracing religions, they tend to become very materialistic. You know, we have these, at least in America, we have these Christian or so-called Christian preachers who say the test of your religiousness, the test of whether or not Jesus is pleased with you, is how rich you are. And of course, they ask all their followers to send them money, and then they say, you know, send me money and then you'll be as rich as I am, and so forth. And these tend to be cheating religions. These sort of religions are compared by Jed Bhattat to King Rahugana in the fifth canto, later on in the fifth canto, as being very shallow rivers with rocks under them. So they look like rivers, but actually they're full of rocks. And it's interesting that Rupa Goswami says that the qualification for taking up bhakti is that one is not too attached or too detached. That one is not too attached, one is not too detached, and that one has some taste for Krishna. So I doubt if we're going to settle this matter once and for all in today's class, but at least we'll look at it and we'll explore it. So the first thing I want to look at is Prabhupada's use of the word disinterested. And then I want to look at this, that Narada Muni was very pleased, and Swayambhuva Manu was, and Lord Brahma, that Narada Muni, Swayambhuva, and Lord Brahma were very pleased with Priyavrata taking up this responsibility. And finally, I want to look at the fact that Swayambhuva Manu was very pleased that he wasn't taking up this responsibility. All right, so let's look at this word disinterested. And we always have a bit of a risk in looking very, very closely at a particular English word used in Srila Prabhupada's books for two reasons. That, first of all, we know that Srila Prabhupada wanted his editors to make his books proper English when he was on the planet. And so it's entirely possible that this particular choice of word was chosen by an editor rather than Srila Prabhupada himself. So we always run that risk if ever that we're going to focus on a particular English word that's in print. You know, when we have a particular English word on a recording, we're safer with that. But the second problem we have is that for Srila Prabhupada, English was not his native language. And therefore, Srila Prabhupada was not always that familiar with the particular connotations of a word. And so, you know, we do run that risk when we look very, very closely at a particular word. The risk is a little less if it's a word that Srila Prabhupada used very frequently, not only in writing, but also in speaking. So having acknowledged that we're taking that risk, I do want to look at this word disinterested. So disinterest is, in English, quite different from being uninterested. So disinterest is something that a neutral party has. For example, a judge in the court is supposed to be disinterested, but the judge certainly is not supposed to be uninterested. In fact, the judge is supposed to be deeply interested in whatever cases come before the court. The judge is supposed to be paying a minute attention to every word and every action of the plaintiff and the defendant and the lawyers and the bailiff and the scribe and everything else. And the judge is supposed to have a very keen interest. They're not supposed to be bored or disengaged. but they are supposed to be disinterested in the sense that they don't have anything to gain personally. If they do, we call that a conflict of interest. Right? Whenever there's a conflict of interest, one is not supposed to be making a decision. This is an ethical principle that is understood, at least theoretically, all over the world. That if we're involved in something where there's a conflict of interest, we're supposed to recuse ourselves. We're supposed to separate ourselves from that particular situation. Recently, I was involved in something with the Shastric Advisory Council where we are making a particular recommendation to the GBC, and the GBC wanted some other group to examine our recommendation. And when they named the people on that group, I said, but one of these people has this and this and this situation. And they said, oh, then that person has a conflict of interest. Yes, so if one has something personal to gain or personal to lose by their decision, something for their own sense gratification, for their own benefit in this world, or for the benefit of those they care about, if a certain decision or a certain way of acting is going to especially favor your family member or your good friend or something like that, then you have a conflict of interest. So the devotee is supposed to take up responsibility in this world with disinterest. Now that seems practically impossible. How does one enter into household life with disinterest? By the very definition, having a conflict of interest involves when your family is involved. It's understood that it's almost impossible to be neutral about a decision or an action if it involves your spouse or your child or your parents or your siblings, that you're going to tend to favor them. I mean, it's quite interesting to me. One friend of mine contacted me a few days ago and was trying to engage me, unsuccessfully, thank you, Krishna, in talking about how in the United States the Supreme Court recently said that abortion is not a constitutional right, and each state can make their own laws regarding abortion. So this devotee friend of mine was trying to engage me in argument about this topic, and I just said, I'm not going to argue about it. But this person was saying, well, you know, I think it's a woman's right to abortion, which surprised me to come from a devotee. And I said, you know, that's an interesting way to put it. And this person said, well, you know, if I was going to die by being pregnant, would you support that? And I said, sure, I'd support abortion to save the life of the mother. And then this person said, well, what about if the mother was going to commit suicide? And I was thinking, well, if I'm not allowed to kill somebody, then I'm going to kill myself. That doesn't seem to be a very good reason. But I didn't really, I didn't take the bait. And then I said to this person, is there someone you know that was suicidal and therefore had an abortion? And they said, yes. And I thought, oh, okay, that's what's happening here. What's happening here is somebody who I know 10 years ago was very much anti-abortion has now become open to it because there's someone that she knows, someone she cares about, who had an abortion because they were suicidal. And so she's changed her way of thinking. And this is very common. You know, that a person will take a particular stance and then someone that they know, you know, they're against transgender, and then their own daughter becomes a transgender man, and so then they become open to it. And this is, it's very typical that one's stance, one's so-called philosophical stance, one's ethical stance, one's moral stance is very much affected by the people that we love. And we can say that this is even true for God, because Krishna says, apichet sucharacharo. He says, even if my devotee does something abominable, if they're my devotee, they're saintly. And one example given by our acharyas of this is Samba, how Samba kidnapped Duryodhana's daughter and at her swayamvar, instead of letting her choose her own husband, he kidnapped her. And still, the Kurus came to his aid. Lord Balaram came, and he threatened Hastinapur, and he came to help out Sambha. So this is something that happens even for God. That God will say, you know, these are my people. These are my people. And Krishna will adjust how he sees things and how he manages things. He'll save his devotee. Of course, it's not always like that. Just like Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was very harsh with Junior Haridas. She was very harsh with, apparently harsh, with his servant Krishna Das, who got allured by the Bhattaharis. So sometimes the Lord takes a very heavy stand, even with his devotees. But this tendency to be more soft-hearted, more open with someone you love is there. So how can you be in household life and be disinterested? It seems to be a contradiction in terms. Right? And how can you run a kingdom? I mean, if you're running the whole universe as the kingdom, then there isn't any other opposing kingdoms. But I would imagine that even when you're running the universe, it means that you're running many, many smaller kingdoms. Each planet has its planetary leader, and within each planet there's so many countries, and there are going to be some that are more favorable to you and more friendly with you, and how are you going to not take any sides? So this disinterest is only possible when one is free from all attachment and aversion. And this concept is really not very well understood at all. That generally we equate being disinterested with being uninterested. We equate neutrality with aversion. Right? We have this famous verse by Yamunacharya, "Whenever I think of sex, I spit at it." And so that sounds pretty averse to us. It sounds like it's a kind of hatred. But actually, it's a kind of neutrality. And this neutrality is the Brahma-Bhuta platform. Brahma-Bhuta prasanat mana sochatina kanchati sama sarveshu bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. Where one just really has no investment in trying to be happy in this world. None at all. Now, that's only possible if one has an investment in being happy somewhere else. Because we're Anandamaya Vyasat, we're pleasure-seeking beings. And we can't simply have no investment in wanting happiness. It's not possible. We have to have our happiness invested elsewhere. So I've told this story many times, how when we lived in Brooklyn, New York, at the Henry Street Temple. So it was, in those days, a rather low-class neighborhood. First of all, in those days, people didn't have to pick up after their dog poop. Nowadays you do, but in those days you didn't. And so people keep dogs in a city, and they take them out for a walk on the sidewalks of the city. And naturally, the dogs are passing a urine and stool on the sidewalks. And in those days, the stool just stayed there. So you always had to be careful where you walked on the sidewalks. And then in the summertime, when it would get very hot, then people would open up the fire hydrants. So when they'd open up the fire hydrants to play in the water, the water would mix with the dog stool that was on the sidewalk, and it would basically be like a big, doggy toilet bowl. And the children are playing in this highly contaminated water. So that was the level of that area. And people would just sit out on the sidewalks in the summer and watch their children playing in this filthy water. So our temple was right there, and I remember one time walking with one of the other ladies to the subway, to the underground station, and we were going to go out on book distribution, and I looked at her and I said, "I'm so happy I don't live here." And she looked at me and she said, "But you do live here." So I didn't have a sense of being part of that neighborhood, although I actually lived there. it really kind of astonished me that I didn't have any mental association with living there. I felt like I lived with the devotees. I mean, we didn't live in the temple. We lived in a flat across the street. But I felt like I lived with the devotees. I didn't feel like I was part of that surrounding atmosphere. So that is the disinterest of the devotee. Like Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about his family. He says, I see my family as your servants. He said, I'm earning a living and I'm taking care of the family, I'm taking care of the house because I see that this is your house and your servants. I'm not seeing them as my family. I'm not seeing them as my wife and my children, my sons, my daughters, my home. Bhaktivinoda has this song where he lists all of these things, even the fences and the gates, he says, they're all yours. You know, we know some people who do what we call house sitting. Actually, someone was just telling me the other day that they do that. You know, they stay in someone else's house and they water their plants and they take care of their pets and their animals and they clean the house while the people are away. And that way they can live in the house for free. Often they get paid as well. But it's not their house. They don't have any personal investment in the house. But they're not uninterested. They're taking very great care without any sense of personal investment. And this is the mystery. How to be so careful. We think of how Srila Prabhupada was so careful. You know, if he saw a dripping faucet or he saw rubbish lying somewhere, even it wasn't on our ISKCON property, he would immediately want to take some action to rectify it. But he had no sense of proprietorship. Krishna talks about this in the 12th chapter. One who has no sense of proprietorship, no attachment for any residence, and no sense of proprietorship, who's an equal friend, who's equal to friends, enemies, and neutral. But because the devotee is taking their happiness internally, this is in the 5th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, one is enjoying the pleasure within. One has, of course, in the 2nd chapter, Param Drisvan Nivartite. One does have a place where one's happiness is invested, but it's not in the temporary changing things of the world for one's own satisfaction. One has an interest in the temporary changing things of the world for Krishna's service, but not for one's own ego, not for one's own satisfaction. Now, this is very easy to talk about and extremely difficult to live. It's extremely difficult to live. As soon as we get some kind of upadhi, as soon as we get some kind of title, you know, I am the in charge of the kitchen at the temple, or I am in charge of the deity worship at the temple, or even I'm in charge of this garden, or something. What to speak of, I am this person's parent, I am this person's spouse. As soon as we get these designations, we tend to want something from that designation for our own ego, for our own gross physical satisfaction. We want to get, you know, free prasadam and a free room or something for our ego. We want people to respect us. I mean, I just got a call the other day from one devotee who's a temple president, and their GBC was dealing with them in a way that I would say was a little harsh. And the temple president was very upset. You know, the GBC was saying, well, you know, you can come and go, but I'm going to stay. And they took it as a threat. I'm going to lose my position. And this temple president had invested a huge amount of personal money into that temple and that community, and a huge amount of personal time and so forth. And, you know, they were upset. They couldn't be disinterested. And it's hard. It's extremely, extremely difficult. One has to have a personal investment in something higher, or this just doesn't work. I love the story about Kaliya, where when Krishna was in the coils of Kaliya, the residents residents of Vrindavan were practically dying because they had invested everything in Krishna. I mean, a nice example of this disinterest is a story about Sachimata with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu when he was young. That when Mahaprabhu was a young boy, he asked his mother, "May I please have a garland to worship the Ganga?" And she said, "Well, I can get it for you in a few minutes. I'm busy with something else." A typical thing that a mother would say to a child. And the Lord had a tantrum. He said, "I want my garland now," a typical way for a child to react. And in having a tantrum, it was such a big tantrum that he actually damaged the house. And he broke everything in the kitchen. And then he went to sleep. When he woke up and he saw that everything was destroyed, it said he felt a little sorry. And Mother Sachi said to him, "This house belongs to you. If you want to destroy it, you can. But now how will I cook for you?" And then the Lord went out and he came back with some gold where Sachimata never found out where he brought it from. But this response of Sachimata, that this house is yours. If you want to break it, fine. If you want to maintain it, fine. You know, it's up to you. So this is this disinterest. Because one's getting one's happiness from the happiness of the Lord. All right, so why is it that Narada and Swayambhuva Manu and Lord Brahma are very happy that Priyavrata is taking up this responsibility? And the answer for this, of course, is fairly easy to understand. This is not something that we need to go into in great depth. It's really very simple, although, again, we have this conflict that goes on perpetually. Within religions, including within the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And that is that Krishna wants his devotees, his responsible devotees, his pure devotees, to rule the world, to manage the world. We would all like it if there was a Krishna-conscious person, at least a God-conscious person, at the heads of the governments of the world. You know, we would love it if the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the UK, etc., was a truly God-conscious person. You know, we would love it if all the High Court judges were like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, if the heads of the companies like Walmart or Monsanto were devotees of the Lord, if the people running all the entertainment industries, all of the news channels and all of the entertainment media channels, if they were all God-conscious persons. You know, what a wonderful, wonderful world this would be if people who were really God-conscious were running everything. You know, I mean, we would love our electrician to be a God-conscious person. We'd love the person who mows our lawn to be a God-conscious person, who works as the cashier in the shop where we buy our fruit. I mean, this is what we would love. We would love the world to be full of God-conscious people. And, of course, this is one of the main teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna wants to renounce, and Krishna is saying, "Mama Nusmam Yujicha," in 8:7. It strikes me as very significant that Krishna says, "Yam yam vapi sram bhavam twaja chante kalevam tam tam eva tikante yastada tad bhava bhavita." He tells Arjuna in 8:6, whatever you think about at the time of death determines where you go. And then you'd think right after that he'd say, so just walk away from the battlefield like you were saying and, you know, go to the forest. And he says, "Mama Nusram Yujicha," think of me while you fight. Of course, Arjuna talked about going away. And we find in chapter 6 that Krishna sort of panders to that and says, fine, Arjuna, if you want to go away, you want to renounce everything, then you have to leave society and you sit on a deerskin and you stare at your nose and, you know, you become a celibate and you just eat the fruits and roots there and you chant Om. And, you know, Arjuna's response to that is, I can't do that. That's not very practical. He says, what'll happen if I fall? So Krishna is pushing this. Take responsibility in the world. Krishna wants that. I mean, Krishna wants the universe. Here we have Priyavrata is taking, my God, what responsibility is he taking? I can't even imagine it. I mean, if I take responsibility just for a small garden, you know, like right now I'm taking responsibility for a little garden here at the temple in Tulsi's greenhouse, and it's a lot. Just taking responsibility for like 20 Tulsi plants can sometimes become completely overwhelming. You know, it can't be too hot and it can't be too cold, and it has to have the right air exchange, and oh, she has this bug and now she has that bug and she has this disease, and it's you know, I can't even imagine if I had to take responsibility for a city or a planet or the whole universe. But this is what Krishna wants, and this is service to do this. It's a great service for Krishna. It's very, very much what he wants. So the fact that Lord Brahma, Swayambhu Manu, and Narada Muni are happy that a devotee of the caliber of Priyavrata is going to take this up is not very difficult to understand. Now, of course, again, we come back to the real versus the ideal, that when one takes up these responsibilities, doing them from a platform of disinterest is extremely difficult. We can understand the concept, we can understand the philosophy of it, but to actually do it, to take up responsibility in the world for Krishna, for his service, with total disinterest, is extremely, extremely difficult. So therefore we come to the last thing, that Swayambhuva Manu is also pleased that he can give it up. I'm so happy now that I can retire, he's saying. I've been running the universe. Now that my son's going to do it, I can retire from it. So this theme, which is of course part of Varnashram, the Vanaprastha and Sannyas aspect of Ashram Dharma, that even if you're working in the world as a service, and even if Krishna is unlimitedly pleased that you're working in the world as a service, he's also very pleased when you get to a point that you turn it over to a young person and you retire. Why? Because it's so difficult to be totally disinterested. And we're going to see this with Priyavrata. That Priyavrata decides at a certain point, after he does all these things in the universe, that, oops, I wasn't totally disinterested. I ended up having some upadis. I ended up having some identification in this world. And that seems to be also a recurring theme in the Bhagavatam. Like Prabhupada comments on Maharaj Parikit getting cursed because he had gotten too attached to his family and his position. Now that's, so it's therefore at a certain time one moves away from that, even though it's service. And this is what confuses people. They think, well, if it's service and it fully is pleasing to Krishna, why would I ever want to walk away from it? The fact that I want to walk away from it at some point must mean that it wasn't really service, that it was some kind of a concession. Well, that's not true. And others may say, well, because it's a real service, therefore everybody should be encouraged to do it at all times in their life, and that isn't true either. And therefore we have this confusion. And we see this confusion manifest in our devotee society when people who should be taking responsibility in the world, taking responsibility for a family, doing something great in the world, are artificially pushed to be renunciates when they're not really renunciates. And then they just simply cause a trouble for themselves or others. And we also see it in our devotee society when people who get old, and there are young people willing and eager to take over, hold on to their positions because they've gotten attached to the perks of those positions and because they think the world can't go on without me. I was hearing Prabhupada the other day talking about this. He often uses Gandhi as an example of someone who held on to his position because he thought, without me, everything's going to fall apart. It's such a temptation to think that way. You know, I think, well, if I go to India for Kartik, what's going to happen to the garden? You know, it'll just get covered with weeds. You know, I'm necessary. I have to be here. I have to do this. I can never retire. I can never die, for goodness sakes, you know. I'm so important because of my little teeny tiny itsy bitsy garden. What to speak of how one would feel about the whole universe. So both of these things are true. For those who are young, for those who are capable, they are supposed to be the agents of God in the world. They are supposed to be the agents of the Lord, as Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, or Shudras. They are supposed to be the agents of the Lord as Grihasthas. They are supposed to provide peace and prosperity in a God-conscious way in the world. And it is also true that at the end of life, when one gets to midlife, end of life, that one should work on succession, on training others, on having those others who are youthful take over, and one should retire. Because probably one became invested in some way or another. Most likely. No matter how much one had a higher taste, no matter how disinterested one was, no matter how detached one was, one probably ended up with some self-identification. We see this very clearly in the story of Bharat Maharaj. So Bharat Maharaj was a great devotee, and as soon as he had a successor, then he retired to the forest as a vanaprastha, and he was experiencing bhava, what to speak of a higher taste. But he hadn't taken from his heart every bit of his false ego identification as the emperor, as the protector of all of the praja, of all of the citizens. And therefore, when there was an abandoned, an orphaned deer, a prematurely born or orphaned deer, his sense of I am the protector, his Ishwara Bhav, his Kshatriya kicked in, and it bewildered him. It pulled him back down to that other place where he was supposed to have let go of. And then it took him another couple lifetimes to get back again. So the right thing at the right time, that we are neither world-embracing nor world-denying. We are neither too attached nor too detached. We appropriately take up the service of the Lord for each of us at the proper time, in the proper way. And when we are dealing with the world, we do our very best to do so from a platform of disinterest, not uninterest, but disinterest, and getting our happiness from a higher platform. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, chastisements, corrections.
This next part is attached to my German manufactured Porsche in 2000.
Jeremy talked a lot about people like, you know, Priya Bhakta that were incredibly involved and with incredible responsibility. But it kind of blew my mind when I heard controlling the entire universe. I mean, that's we're universes. That's pretty big time. And I got it about the importance of getting involved and doing something because we're here. But isn't there room, or is there room for those who are not so inclined to get involved, that are just almost as children, they're kind of renunciates at heart, and they just engage themselves in their devotional practices without getting involved at all? They just don't have that inclination.
There certainly is, but that should be always a very small percentage, because it is a very small percentage. So the number of people who don't have desires that need to be dovetailed are extremely small, always have been. I mean, if you look at any religious system, the percentage of adherents that are full-time monks and nuns is always, it's infinitesimal. It's a tiny, tiny portion of the population of that religious system. That people who, from a youthful age, separate themselves from the world almost entirely. And I mean, frankly, as preachers in Mahaprabhu's movement, you know, our Srila Prabhupada really encouraged us to be preachers. There's no full separation from the world. You know, that to really separate yourself from the world, you have to be a Bhajanandi. And of course, we have Bhajanandis in our tradition. We have Gorkhasura Das Babaji. Of course, he did that later. He was not a lifetime Bhajanandi. That was later in life. He had been married. He had been a grain dealer. We have Bhakti Vinod, who became a Bhajanandi in the last 4 years of his life. you know, but this concept of being a lifetime Bhajanandi is not so active in the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But say, even if you're a lifetime preacher, you're interacting with the world, and you may be taking a lot of responsibility in the world. You know, if you're taking responsibility for a temple or even a monastery or a school, that can be significant. That's not a small thing. And doing so can end up with the same sort of issues of dealing with whether or not you can be completely disinterested. So the number of people who really just separate themselves, you know, it's tiny. It's really, really, really tiny. And it's not something that's generally encouraged. I mean, we are encouraged to take responsibility in Mahaprabhu's movement. I mean, I'm just thinking about Madhavendra Puri. Madhavendra Puri was like that. He traveled alone. He didn't even beg. If somebody voluntarily offered him food, he would take it. But he didn't even ask anybody for food. And he didn't have a companion because he didn't want to risk talking nonsense. You know, there's that analogy in the 11th canto that if you have two bangles on one arm, they'll clang together. You know, it's pretty hard to have another person and only talk Krishna Katha. That's pretty hard. So that was his mood. And then, you know, he had this dream about Gopal, and he found this deity of Gopal, and he established a temple. And he engaged, you know, other brahmanas and started taking responsibility. And this is quite a common thing that we find in the followers of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that we take some responsibility in the world, even if one doesn't marry and doesn't, you know, take up some profession exactly. It doesn't really take up like a varna profession. It doesn't take on a family. Still, we see people taking responsibility that can be equal or greater. I mean, I know in our ISKCON movement, there are persons who've never married, and they've never had any kind of a career in the ordinary sense, but they run, you know, they're GBC members who are managing many, many temples and thousands of devotees. So, you know, that's pretty hard to get away from. At the same time, what I have seen is that even people taking that kind of responsibility, it's good for them to retire from that at some point. I was recently, I went to a series of seminars by one of my senior godbrothers who for decades was a GBC and before that a temple president, and has last couple years left that situation and is just studying and teaching Shastra. And it was wonderful. You know, he asked me for some feedback after his presentation, and I said, my main feedback is that being free of management seems to be very suitable for you. And it was something that a lot of other people noticed as well. It was just like the person could be soft-hearted because they weren't responsible for management anymore. They weren't responsible for taking care of this project and that legal thing and so forth. So even in Mahaprabhu's service, it does seem that it's wise for people near the end of life to give up those sort of situations. Does that answer your question? Thank
you. That's a great answer. Thank you very much.
And Namananda Prabhu, I see you have a hand raised.
Okay, real quick. I mean, it's related to what you just said, but when I was thinking about Swayambhuva Manu, before you start giving class, even before you gave the lecture, you know, because most people, if they're in a high position, as Srila Prabhupada said in the purport, that's where they want to stay, because that's where they get power. What you were stressing was that if you get in a position of ruling over other people, that you will develop upadis, and therefore you'll get attached to this material world and misery. So what I was thinking is that in my minute experience, whenever I was in charge of other people, that it wasn't so much that about upadis, but it was more stress. for the weight of responsibility that just killed me, and I would never want to do it again. So my question is that just because it's not my nature and I'm not good at managing other people, or is it that actually the point is that because of the weight of responsibility or stress that it entails, that's why you want to renounce it, at least at a certain point in life?
Well, probably a little of both. I mean, like, I know some members of the GBC that just blossom as being members of the GBC because it's their nature. So if a person has a nature of managing other people and taking on that kind of responsibility, then they blossom in that situation. And in fact, if you don't put them in that situation, they'll kind of try to do it improperly. So there are people who are, by their nature, by their own qualities, thrive under taking responsibility like that for other people and for projects. It's where they're best situated. And as I said, if they don't have those sort of positions, they'll end up trying to manage others in ways that are unpalatable because they're natural managers and they're natural leaders. So if someone is improperly situated, I mean, Krishna makes this point so strongly in the Bhagavad Gita, that's one thing that's going to be very draining. If we're situated properly, then our activities will enliven us and not drain us. It's one of the symptoms that we're situated properly, is that we love what we're doing, and that it fills us with happiness, it fills us with energy, it fills us with enthusiasm. We feel like we are in the right place. We feel like we're doing what we should be doing. But there is a kind of weight of taking responsibility. I know I felt that when I became the chairperson of the Shastric Advisory Council instead of just a member. I mean, the first few months, it was almost unbearable. I mean, at this point, I've kind of become accustomed to it. It's just like, you know, if you're carrying something around all the time, you just kind of get used to it. You feel that it's just what it is. But in the beginning, it was very intense. You know, and a similar thing happened to me when I became principal of a school rather than just being a teacher. You know, there was this huge shift, and I felt it very acutely for the first few months. And it's a lonely place to be, actually, when you have that kind of responsibility. People who've never had that kind of responsibility don't understand it, they don't relate to it. It is very difficult. It is a feel like it's something. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur talked about these burdens as being a great pleasure when being done for the service of the Lord. So, you know, if it is our nature, if it is our propensity, if we are really good at it, it's something that we feel is a pleasure. At the same time, I would be thrilled if somebody else became the chairperson of the Shastric Advisory Council because it is this big responsibility that I really didn't have when I was a member. When I was a member, I could just do my little thing and walk away. So that's also there. But the main problem that we have with these situations is our becoming attached in some way. That's the main problem. And that can happen even if you're just, you know, a little person. Even if you're just like, you know, doing some little thing in the world, and you can become attached to that, and you become identify with that. So that's more the main problem. But if you're not happy in a situation, it generally means that you're wrongly situated, that you're situated in something that's outside of your nature. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, very good. Do you have time for Madan Mohan?
Yeah, I had another thing coming up, but that person canceled, so I could take one more. Yes, Madan Mohan.
It's a comment on how you mentioned there's conflict of interest.
Yes.
When you're a family member, and I was thinking of like Lord Ramachandra, he ran into some executive decisions that he made that seemed, but one of the ideas that I came up with is that the wife is probably also highly qualified, as opposed to, you know, just thinking that he has an ordinary situation. He's an extraordinary person. He has an extraordinary wife who could understand when he has to make different decisions, you know, where an ordinary person would have the difficulties and conflict of interest, there's a learning experience both for the husband and the wife. So they're actually making advancement in dealing with the different situations also. What do you think?
I think that's true, but still it's difficult. You know, the
difficulty is a constant.
It's definitely difficult, and the example that Lord Ramachandra sent is extraordinary. You know, and it's something that we as devotees struggle with. You know, it's a difficult thing. How could you do that? How could you do that to your wife for the sake of the kingdom? It's something that it's hard.
What was her response? Do we ever get her side of the story?
Well, of course, we know her response at the end when Lord Ramachandra says to her, you know, I'm sorry, you can come back. And she's like, forget it. I'm out of here. I'm not going to go through that again.
I don't know if I interpret that or I can assimilate it, you know, just by understanding what her different moods. I have a tendency to project my mood onto her, you know, to think how I would think, as opposed
well,
to...
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, it's way, way beyond my pay grade to say what Sita's mentality is. But certainly Sita always loved Ram and she never blamed him. And as her, you know, herself being practically speaking as qualified as he is, so she accepted that this is the part of the thing. And of course, there's a rasa thing going on with Vipralamba.
I was thinking that also is that everything has got lessons for us. You know, the whole material world is set up for us to learn from, and these great examples are showing us how to do things properly. So they're all surcharge, but at the same time that, as you pointing out, the difficulties are there, and happiness in this world isn't the way that it seems it is. It's not where it looks like it is.
Yes.
So that's also the experience that we're getting. So I was just thinking, you know, that there's so many different lessons that they teach us by their exemplary activities.
Definitely. I mean, the thing that's again with Sita and Ram, you know, we have a strong rasa component that's going on there. But we also have these, you know, totally extraordinary lessons that most, you know, souls wouldn't be able to just copy. These extreme examples of...
I mean, this Priyavarta's wife, isn't that... she's quite extraordinary, too. I think it's brought up where she came from, and there's quite a bit of history there.
Yes. Yes, it's also like that. They're also, well, that's what's recommended throughout the Shastra, is that one marries someone of equal quality, of equal caliber to oneself. All right, I should end now. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada, ki jai.
Thank you.